Ladies and gentlemen, we are nearing the close of this convention, sadly. But you ever go to a conference or a convention or a seminar, and the speaker gets up there and he says, "Our next speaker needs no introduction." I'm always disappointed because I want to know who's going to be talking to me. But the truth is, the next speaker does need an introduction. But we don't have any time for it. Ladies and gentlemen, Rabbi David Orlovsky.
Good for you.
That's good for you.
So this fellow wasn't such a good guy. And he gets to the next world and they say, "I'm sorry, you're going to have to spend some time down there." So he says, "Oh, well, what's the deal?" He says, "Well, it's not like the old days. Now you have options. You always have options." "So what are your options?" "Well, you can go to French Gehenna, American Gehenna, or Israeli Gehenna." "So what's the difference?" "Well, French Gehenna, you spend the day strolling on the boulevard, you go to a cafe, you know, have a glass of wine, go to the ballet, and at midnight they put you in the most boiling hot water and you stay there till the morning." He says, "It sounds terrible." He says, "Oh, it is." He says, "Well, what's American Gehenna?" "American Gehenna, you get to go to shopping malls, you get to go to fancy restaurants, you go to baseball games, and at midnight they put you in the most boiling hot water and you stay there till the morning." He says, "It sounds terrible." "So it is." He says, "What's Israeli Gehenna?" "Israeli Gehenna, you get up early in the morning, you work on a kibbutz picking apples, you get a pita and a leaven for lunch, and at midnight they put you in the most boiling hot water and you stay there till the morning." He says, "Why would anyone take the Israeli Gehenna?" "Well, midnight's not really midnight. And the water's not so hot. Well, if you don't like a pita and leaven, we can get you a schnitzel, you know what I mean?" So ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Israeli Gehenna. I started speaking an hour and a half ago. I hope it's going well. You know, I understand this happens sometimes with conferences. These things go very late, you know. There was one time there was speaker after speaker, and one by, you watch people leaving. You watch people walking out one by one. People were leaving, you know. And by the way, if anybody has to leave, I have no objection. I don't want anyone to be, you know, if you have to leave, you go. Just don't say, "I've had enough of this," and slam the door on the way out. Okay, it gets a little touchy about that. That happens a lot. But you know, so one by one, people are leaving, and finally, you know, the person sitting on the dais is watching more and more people leave. By the time he gets up, there's one person left standing there. What's he going to do? He gets up, and he's like, "I'd like to thank you for coming, you know." So, and he gives his whole drasha, you know. And at the end, he steps down the podium, and he says to the guy, he says, "Listen, I really appreciate you staying. It's a tremendous kavod, you know, I mean, that you stayed." The guy says, "Don't get too touched. I'm the next speaker." So I'd like to point out that just by looking over, listening to the people, and looking through the, you know, the program, I obviously missed a really great Shabbos, and I really wish that I had been here. Of course, I wasn't invited, but I wish that I could have been here, because I look at the lineup of all the most amazing speakers, and I'm really glad that they saved me for the end, so that everybody left. And I actually do well with closings. I was invited to speak at the Agudah convention. This was a very big highlight for me. They called me up and asked me if they would like me to come to the Agudah convention. So I said, you know, "Well, aren't you a little nervous to invite me? I might say something controversial. I have a reputation for that, you know." He said, "Aren't you a little nervous?" And they said, "Yes, we discussed this in committee." "So we're going to give you the ladies' shalosh shudas because none of the Rosh Yeshiva come to that. And we'll give you the closing Sunday morning because all the Rosh Yeshiva leave on Motzi Shabbos." I said, "I was kidding. I didn't realize this was actually a discussion. How could we invite Orlovsky and minimize the damage?" So it is really very exciting that Project Inspire invited me in any context. And I certainly want to thank Rabbi Samson and Rabbi Trapp for having me. And, you know, and certainly the wonderful, wonderful introduction, which I'll always cherish. Good friend Yaakov Salomon. I was a young boy in Camp Stechemet when Yaakov Salomon was the learning director. And I remember thinking at the time how inspired I was from his words. And now I'm thinking, I didn't realize you were so old. And I don't tell anybody I know him because I say, "I went to see Yaakov Salomon," and he said, "Are you feeling better?" In any event, so when I went to do this closing, I was doing the closing actually with my good friend Pesach Perron, and Pesach said to me, "Listen, I'll give you a piece of advice." He says, "It's the end of the convention. Don't talk about the theme. Everybody has heard the theme. Everybody talks about the theme. It's been talked to death. Talk about something else, you know?" And I said, "You know, do you think that's a really good piece of advice? You know what I mean?" And he says, yeah. He says, "I think this is really the way to go." And I'm not saying this because Pesach Perron said it, because I don't like to name drop and just show off that I'm friends with all kinds of important people. It was one of the things he told me is never name drop. And he said he heard that from his good friend, Rabbi Frant. So, so I wanted to take maybe a different approach. maybe a different approach. And that is, I'll tell you another story that happened at the Jewish convention. That was really amazing because they invited me is because of something that had happened several years earlier. I have a chassid. I have a number of chassidim. None of them are actually chassidim. And, the traveling chassidim, one of them came to tell me that he's actually a chassid of mine, and he really is a chassid. So this is really very exciting. The first actual chassid that I ever had was a chassid. But usually my chassidim are not chassidim. But he had an inn in the Aguda Convention, and he really wanted me to come and speak. And the Aguda Convention did not want me to really come and speak. And so he badgered them until they agreed to bring me in on a round table on Kir V'Chokim on a Friday morning. And I said, "Look, I don't really want to go." And they said, "No, we really want you to go." And he badgered them until they agreed to bring me in. And they said to me, "Listen, we can't really list you because you're, you know, we already have everything set. But you'll be slightly off the round table. You know what I mean? And then we'll call upon you to say a few words." You see where this is going already, right? Okay. Anyway, so comes the round table, which was actually a square table, and a number of professionals get up to speak, you know, mostly with Balabatim supporting different Kiruv organizations. They all had prepared presentations. Everyone spoke for about 25, 30 minutes, you know, and they were all giving their different presentations, and I really felt like a fifth wheel. I really felt like I didn't belong there at all. So finally the moderator turns to me and says, "Do you want to speak?" And I said, "No. Really, I had enough. I'm really, it was a pleasure to be here, you know." So he says, "And now I'd like to introduce Rabbi Orlovsky to say a few words." So I got up and I said, "You know, we're all talking about Kiruv HaChokhem. We're all talking about the importance of Kiruv HaChokhem. I have a different question. What for? What for? You know, we have a lot of demands in the Frum community. Right? We have yeshivas that need a lot of money, especially in these difficult economic times. We've got kids who are off the derech. We have families that are in need. We have, you know, mikvahs. So why are we doing kiruv? Why are we doing kiruv? What is the point of this? Aren't there other priorities in the Frum community?" And I have to tell you, you just have to open up any Jewish publication and you can see all the different needs that are there. Why is this a priority? You can imagine everybody on the panel was beginning to feel somewhat uncomfortable. The moderator was trying to decide why he did introduce me. And I said, "I'll tell you why." And I began to list some of the problems in the Frum community, which I'm not going to go into now at length. But there are a lot of problems. And there's a lot of, you know, people who are uninspired, to say the least. And a lot of people who are doing things by rote. And a lot of things that are just sort of happening. And I remember this question came up once. I was with Mati Berger. And Mati Berger says, "I'll tell you why we have to do Kiruv HaChokhem." He says, "It's the only hope for the Frum community." And that made such a dramatic impact on me at the time. And it reminded me when I was the Long Island director of NCSY, and there was a panel discussing the role of day school kids who were coming to NCSY. Why should day school kids come? Should they come? And, you know, principal after principal said, "Well, only if they're there to give, and only if they're there to, you know, donate, only if they're there, you know." And every kid who was had been involved as a yeshiva kid raised his hand and said, "We never came to give. We came to get. I have been benching since the age of 5. I must tell you that benching is probably one of the least inspiring things to me. Those of us who have teenagers have seen the level of enthusiasm with which they sit down to bench. Can I go? You have to bench. Can I go now? You know? No, we're going to sing the benching. Try that with a group of teenagers who've been benching since the age of 5. Look at the looks of excitement and glee on their faces." Gosh, I'm telling you, once you hit Noda, it's all over because Noda doesn't even have a tune. And everyone's like going out of their minds, you know? No, who wants the band? You've been doing this for 15 years. Forget it, you know? He says, and I come to a Shabbaton and I see a kid with hair down to here and an earring sitting here with a transliterated bencher, breaking his teeth, trying to bench, and suddenly I say, I'm missing something. I'm missing something. There was a comedian who became a Baal Tshuva, and he used to do a show based on his experiences. And one time he got up and he said, I'm proud to say I'm no longer Baal Tshuva. I talk during davening. You know? What a sad commentary. You understand? But there is a problem, and the problem is very real. The problem is that there are a lot of frum people, and I would say the frum community, there's a lot of problem of where is the excitement and the inspiration? Why is so much of it coming from Baal Tshuva? Why is it that we... So I did this whole presentation at the Yigud Convention, and the place exploded. You know, in the audience were people like, Meir Shuster and Jonathan Rosenblum and, David Schenker runs Jeff on Long Island, all the professionals in the audience. And they all said, Rabbi Olesky's right. Yes, I have to agree with Rabbi Olesky. And it was clearly they had lost control of the crowd and I hadn't been invited back for about 6 years. But Jonathan Rosenblum said, I have to point out something. Do you notice why so many books on Hashgafa are written by Baal Tshuva? He says, because they're approaching Torah as an adult. We ask a question when we're in second grade, third grade, fourth grade. We get an answer. We're content. He says, Baal Tshuva are not. These are university-educated people who are now first coming and looking at Torah, and they want to hear it on a higher level, on a deeper level. They're looking at it on a deeper point, and they give insights that can inspire other people. I'm a firm believer in being selfish. I believe in selfishness. I've tried to develop it to a fine art in my own case. Somebody once said to me, when they write my biography, it'll be called All for the Bucks. So, Hashem. I am the polar opposite of Rabbi Lev. Rabbi Lev lives for the Jewish people. Rabbi Lev, I don't even want to embarrass him by telling him stories, because usually in Yerushalayim is what I do. I'm constantly introducing Rabbi Lev, you know what I mean? So I don't want to use up any of my material here. But he is just, completely, completely l'shem shemayim, and I am so completely not. And I really believe that, we always should look at things from a position of self-interest. General Patton said such an amazing concept once to his troops. He said, I'm not looking for people who want to die for their country. You don't win wars by dying for your country. You win wars by making the other guy die for his country. You know what I mean? I'm not looking for Mesiras Nefesh. Don't be Moisa Nefesh for Kirib Rechokim. Don't sacrifice to bring in some poor lost soul into your house. Oh, look, this is Billy, my Baal Tshuva. Hi, say something Baal Tshuva for the people. Baruch Hashem. Thank you, Billy. Now go sit over there and don't touch the wine, all right? You ever see these people? How many people did you make fun from? I made 17 people from, oh yeah? Well, I made 16, but I'll have another. Hi, how are you? What's your name? Let's dance, you know what I mean? I'm going to put a notch on my belt. You know how many people I made from? I never made anybody from, you know? And I always tell people, if I'm going to take credit for the successes, I have to take responsibility for the failures. That means that every person I worked on that didn't become from is my fault. I don't want that on my head. Therefore, I'm there to educate, I'm there to inspire, I'm there to teach. But I must tell you that when we do this, we're the ones who so often gain from the experience. We see things that inspire us. And I always thought to myself that Project Inspire is really talking about inspiring us as opposed to us inspiring us to go and help them. It's inspiring us to be inspired. The things that we have an opportunity to see is something that is so incredible, and we have it. So I would like to speak just for a moment of self-interest. I should throw in some Torah here just for a change of pace. Past week is Parshat Chukosai. Parshat Chukosai are the brachas and the klolas. Very, very, very few brachas and lots of klolas, because we might as well deal with the reality of Klal Yisrael. So among the brachas is the following pasuk. It's Perek Chavav, pasuk Ches, V'rodfu mikem chamisha, meya u'meya mikem revavu yerdofu. Yeah? Five of you will chase 100, and 100 of you will chase 10,000. Says Rashi, Kikaku acheshven, it doesn't work. If five of you will chase 100, how much is each person chasing? I want to point out I've heard three different answers here. So if you want to get your calculators out, that's okay with me. My kids can't add anything without a calculator. You know what I mean? I tried to explain to them. When I went to school, we had this calculator. It was called a pencil. You know what I mean? You know? Yeah. So if five of you were chasing 100, how much is each individual chasing? There you go. Baruch Hashem. Somebody paid attention during those SAT preparation courses. Right. So each one of you is chasing 100. If 100 is chasing 10,000, how much is each individual chasing?
1,000.
You know, I'm so glad that we're dealing here with the educated public. This is easy. You like cut off zeros here, okay? Let's try again. If 100 is chasing 10,000, how much is each one chasing? Okay, is that your final answer? You want a lifeline? Want to call a friend? Anyway, and we'll vote for the studio audience. Anyway, who wants to be a kiruv worker? In any event, so if one of you is going to chase 20, if 100 chases 10,000, that means each one is chasing 100. That doesn't work out right. It should have been 5 chases 100, and 100 chases 2,000. Says Rashi, you cannot compare when a lot of people are keeping the Torah to when a few small percentage are keeping the Torah. What does that mean? Five of you are going to chase 100, that means there aren't that many people keeping the Torah. 100 of you chase 10,000, you have 100. If we look at it as 100 being at 100%, and you know, 5 being at 5%, right? So 100, every individual can chase 100 of the enemies. Each individual. If Mu'utan are keeping the Torah, each individual is chasing 20 of the enemy. That means that when more people are keeping the Torah, I have a greater potential of what I can do in this world. We never realize that. When we're talking about bringing in people, we're talking about reaching out to Klal Yisrael. It's not for them, it's for us. It means that I'm half a Jew, in this case 20% of a Jew that I would be otherwise. I wanted to make a suggestion. This is my own idea, and I haven't seen it anywhere, but you know, what's the idea of if Reuben is in the Torah, everyone would teach 100. And if Me'udma is in the Torah, it drops down to 20. You're only 20% instead of 100%. You've lost 80%. Why is that the ratio? Say 5 will chase 10, 5 will chase 5. Why 5 will chase 100? What's that number? Why 20% of what we'd otherwise be? And I wanted to suggest, because we know the famous Rashi, Chamushim olu b'nei Yisrael me'eretz Mitzrayim, only 1/5 came out of Mitzrayim. Only 20%. And the Gemara tells us it will be the same thing b'yamos Mashiach. 20%. What does that mean? That means that there's a minimum threshold. We could be at 100%, but we're not going to drop down lower than 20%. This is to eliminate the very poor argument of why people should, you know, get involved in Yahadus. You know, is because otherwise we're going to vanish. The Jewish people are going to vanish. We're disappearing. No, we're not. We're fine. Don't worry about it. Klal Yisrael will always be here. Don't worry about that. The question is, how much of Klal Yisrael will be here? And when we ask how much of Klal Yisrael will be here, we ask, and how powerful will each individual be? It's not a question of going out and reaching out to them. It's a question of us becoming Klal Yisrael, more of what we're supposed to be. More of us being able to accomplish it. In general, I don't believe that any message like that is going to be effective. People who give arguments like, well, you have to become Jewish because you're going to vanish. It doesn't work. It doesn't work. I don't think it's true, but I don't even think it works. It's not effective. Because we all know the difference. I was, the difference when an executive director comes to visit. Executive director means that you're dealing with somebody who's really a major league schnorrer. He's not just a poor, he's a really major league one. He's not going to come and talk to you for less than $100,000 if he's in a hospital or university. You know what I mean? If it's not a major contribution, don't even waste our time. People line up to be able to give enough money to be able to consider choshev, you know? Moshe Enkin, someone comes around going, Avnosis Kala, you know, you'll give him $1, you're already a big tzaddik, you know what I mean? Give him $5, you know what I mean? You expect a plaque, you know what I mean? When we go to a hospital, we get $1 million, they won't even give you a decent plaque, you know? That's the difference between being an executive director and being a schnorrer. When you come over and say, we're vanishing, we're dying, Klal Yisrael is vanishing, we're not going to be here, want to join? Hi, my company's going out of business. Want to invest? You know? Quick, I think I can still get some of your money over to Madoff. You know what I mean? I think I can get you in on the bottom. If we hurry. Who wants to get on a sinking ship? If Klal Yisrael is sinking, if everything is terrible, if everything is over, then forget about it. You know? There are lots of terrible arguments that are given why people should be Jewish. Terrible arguments, you know? We've been around for so long. I don't know if you've ever heard that one. That's one of my favorites. We've been around for so long. Oh, I'm sorry, was there some ancient people contest I entered? Surely we've won by now. Who are we still running against? You know what I mean? Let's have the award ceremony and move on, you know? Jews have made wonderful contributions to society. So did the Etruscans. You know what I mean? And then they moved out of the way. Make room for somebody else. Terrific. Have a round of applause for the Jewish people and step off to the side. You know what I mean? You know? We have to preserve Jewish culture. Why? Because otherwise it'll die. Why? Because nobody likes it. That's why. Do you find Italians raising money to get people to eat lasagna? No. People like lasagna. But you have to pay people to come down and eat gefilte fish, because otherwise they're going to ask that uncomfortable question, what is the goo in the jar? And tell me in your heart of hearts you've never asked that question. So you think of an unreligious person, you open up this big jar of gefilte fish and you're fishing through, you know? Look what I caught. Hey, let's crank up some klezmer and dance the horror and eat gefilte fish. What do you say? Yeah. Let's preserve Jewish culture, you know? I don't know. You see arguments that are being given that all of them are based on the fact that we're a Nebuch, you know? And it's unfortunate. I had somebody who, his approach to Kiruv was, there's a Kodesh Baruch Hu, and there's going to be a Yom HaDin, and there's a Gehenna, and there's an Olam Haba, and you don't want to go to Gehenna, and a Kodesh Baruch Hu is going to burn you, and that, you know? And he was always surprised why that didn't meet with success. And I have to tell you how many times I talked to people who were starting off in the field, and I pushed them. You know, I said, what are you going to tell people? What are you going to tell them, you know? And they say things like, you know, well, you know, I give you a scenario. I remember I was also second once on a panel in Kiruv Rechokim, you know, and this fellow gets up and he says, you know, he said, I'll say to a firm audience, you know, I say, okay, I have a fellow. He's a successful doctor. How many people would have trouble telling him why he should become firm? Some hands go up. I said, he has a beautiful wife, a wonderful marriage. They have good communication. More hands go up, you know? Says, he's got 3 beautiful children. They're well behaved. You know what I mean? They're not chutzif. You know, they go to school, they all do well. How many people would have trouble telling this guy to come from? More hands go up. You know what I mean? He volunteers, you know, in poor neighborhoods to treat poor people for free. You know what I mean? And he has a lot of meaning. How many people? More hands go up. You know, Sunday night the whole family comes together. They have a dinner. They discuss ideas, have family time. You know, by the time he finishes building this up, You know, there's like no hands left. You know, what am I going to tell this guy where you come from? I said, don't you understand? Your underlying assumption is if you're becoming from, it's only because there's something wrong with you. You've got to be such a nebuch. You know what I mean? Strung out and drugged someplace. You know what I mean? Broken family. My marriage is collapsing. My kids hate me. You know what I mean? Might as well become from. My life is over anyway. You know what I mean? You know? How much worse can it get? But a person who's happy and normal? I was working for a particular cure organization once, and there was this fellow who was already in graduate school. He was on his way to a great career. You know, they came for a meal, you know, and I said, where do you guys usually eat out? They said, we don't. I said, why? He goes, we eat in seminary. I said, why? He goes, it's too painful. I said, what do you mean? He says, you know how many times we go to from people's houses and they say to us, you used to not be from? Did you ever do this? Did you ever eat that? Did you ever go here? It's like the stuff that makes us sick that we've turned our back on, I see from people excited about. It's like they're living vicariously through the avers that we've done. What a condemnation of us. What a condemnation of us. That's the problem. The problem is if people aren't thrilled that we're from, if this is not the greatest thing in the world, you know? If a person in their heart of hearts is saying, I'm from because there's a din and the Yom HaDin and the Kodesh Baruch Hu is going to burn me in Gehenna and I have to do this. And I once told the yeshiva guy, he was telling me, I'm going to burn a Gehenna. And I said, you don't really think there's flames and fires, pitchforks, little devils and stuff like that. But you know, you're in a neshama, right? Your body stays here. You know, if you're nervous, you know, pay money for Sarogenics and get it frozen, you know what I mean? And keep you in aluminum foil, you know what I mean? You know flames, you know what I mean? I said, you understand? He says, don't tell me that. That's the only reason I get up in the morning to go to shul. I said, okay, we'll open up a special section for you. Get special flames, you know. So otherwise, why get up? Why get up? How many times have people played that game? What would you do if a Kodesh Baruch Hu came to you and gave you 24 hours off? It won't be any pagam on your neshama. There won't be any timtum aleif. There won't be any long-lasting approach. It won't count in the din l'cheshbon. This whole day is coming out of that video. You can do whatever you want. How many people say, what do you mean I would do the same thing I do now? I do. You know? To me, it would be analogous to my wife saying to me, you know, you have such a hard schedule. Things are so difficult. I know you travel around the world, you know. It's such difficult. In fact, I left Friday morning, and I just spoke to my wife driving up here to the convention, and she told me Friday night, my four-year-old came down with chicken pox. And let me tell you how terrible I feel that I'm not there to help. Yeah, anyway. Let me take another moment to reflect on this. Anyway. This is a kid who scratches every mosquito bite he gets. You know what I mean? You know? And now he's got chicken pox. Oy, my boy. All I can hope is that it's a short, you know, bout and it ends quickly before I get home. Anyway. But my wife, who I love dearly, you know, Chabkim Sivan, we're going to be married 28 years, you know, and you know, my wife said to me the other day, I want to thank you for 26 of the happiest years of my life. And I said, honey, we're married 28. She said, the first two, you know. Anyway. But, so imagine I come back, and my wife says to me, listen, you travel so much, you have such a busy schedule. You know what? Tomorrow, you don't have to talk to me. I don't want you to feel obligated. Pretend we're not married. Don't talk to me, you know, just go out and hang out with your friends, whatever you want. I would be so hurt. You know what I mean? I actually like my wife. You know what I mean? You know? Why in the world would I want an opportunity to walk away from that? And people who look at Yahadus and look at a Kodesh Baruch Hu and we say to ourselves, you know, gee, I wish I had a day off. I wish I didn't have to deal with you. What a depressing concept. You know, and this is one of the biggest problems that we have. I teach Mesillas Yesharim in Eretz Yisrael, and I want to share with you just the first two lines. You know, Perek Aleph, I can't tell you how many times people say to me, you know, Mesillas Yesharim, it's so esoteric, it doesn't speak to us, you know. I've never found that to be true. You know, there was one time I was teaching in a particular yeshiva, and you know, people were laughing, we were having, you know, making some very realistic, real-life points, you know. And a Yushami's passing by, and he pokes his head in. And he says, what are they learning here? He says, Mesillas Yesharim. He says, I don't remember it being that funny. the fact of the matter is that, you know, Yisod HaChassidus v'Shorash HaAvodah Tmimihi. Yeah, she is bari, is amitil adam achal vasva lamam. The root of everything is to know why you are in this world. Why are you here? You know what a hard question that is for most people to answer? Why are you alive? Okay, so you go to a non-Jewish person. Why are you in this world? What are you doing in this world? What's your goal in life? Guy says, I want to be a dentist. My goal in life is to be a dentist. I said, no, it's not. He said, sure it is. I said, I'll prove to you it's not. You're 90 years old, you're on your deathbed, they're writing a eulogy, you get to listen in. He was a dentist. He filled many cavities. He removed many impacted teeth. He was especially good with molars. The guy says, stop. I said, no, I'm getting to the best part. Your tombstone is a big tooth. And it says, here lies a dentist. He just filled his last cavity. Well, that's bad taste even for me, you know? Anyway, I almost feel bad. But anyway, the guy says, no, you misunderstood. I said, I misunderstood. He goes, yeah, I don't mean that's my goal in life. I want to earn my living from dentistry. I said, oh, I misunderstood. What's your goal in life? He says, I have no idea. I used to tell people I want to be a dentist. Everyone said, good for you. You're the first one who ever called me on it. You know? So that, okay. You know, you see people and you say to them, why are you alive? What do you say to somebody? Why are you Jewish? You know? I was giving a class in Asia on intermarriage, and I'm 5 minutes into the class, and this girl bursts into tears and runs out of the room. And I was surprised, because it usually takes me a half an hour before anybody bursts into tears and runs out of the room. So I went to see what I said at the end of the class that upset her so much so I could use it again. And because it's a tough class to give, you know. And she says, no, it's not you. And I said, too bad. So what is it? She says, this is just a very emotional topic for me. I said, why? She says, I come from a strong Jewish background. I said, what does that mean? You know, we went to synagogue on the high holidays. I had a bat mitzvah. You know what I mean? My father belonged to the men's club. We put an electric menorah in the window on Hanukkah. You know, we had a Passover Seder. You know, a traditional Jewish home. And the one thing I always knew is I would never intermarry because my Judaism is so important to me. Fine. I went off to high school. I dated some non-Jewish boys, but I knew nothing would come of it because my Jews were so important to me. Fine. I went to university. I met a nice non-Jewish guy, and I dated him for 2 years, and then I fell in love. Now, for the benefit of the gentleman, I really have to translate. She didn't say I fell in love. That's how a man would say it. She said, and then I fell in love. So the ladies already know what she said, because it was obvious, right? What she meant was, it's not my fault. I wasn't planning to fall in love. You understand? It just happened by itself. You know how many times I hear this from people? I wasn't planning to fall in love. Sometimes I'll be halfway through a class on intermarriage. I said, how many people now intermarry? No hands go up. I said, how many will interdate? All the hands go up. They say, it's just a date. You know, it's just a date. I said, do you know anyone who got married without dating? Did any of your parents get married without dating? All the years I'm doing this, one time a guy raises his hand. I said, your parents got married without dating? They said, yeah, they're Hasidish. I said, what are you doing in an intermarriage class? You know what I mean? Do you five-ish, bane-ish, take Christina to be a... It's not going to happen, you know? I said, about the rest of you? Any of you here, you know? Any of you, parents get married without dating, you know? So they said, I said, you know, nobody plans to fall in love. So a guy says, if I find myself falling in love, I'll break it off. I said, well, that's great. Invite me. I'm going to watch this. Christina, yes. I can never see you again. Why? Because I'm starting to love you. I said, you're going to do that? I don't think even you're that shallow. He turns to his friend. He says, what do you think? He says, yeah, you're that shallow. I can say that. You know? But most people, they fall in love. Says it was this girl. She says, I fell in love. I said, so? Because I know I wouldn't intermarry because my Jews were so important to me. So I told him if he'd convert, I'd marry him. I'm always surprised by this response. It's based on the assumption that you don't care about your religion either, so why don't you convert, you know? So they said, he said, okay. He agreed. They were conservative. He signed up for a 6-month conversion course. She relocates to a city. They start planning the wedding. Everything's moving along. Halfway through the course, he says, I can't go through it. I didn't realize my mother would be so upset. I didn't realize my Catholicism meant so much to me. I can't do it. If you want, I'll marry you the way you are. You know, if you want, you can convert, but I can't do this. So with tears in her eyes, she said to me, I broke it off. And I said to her, why? By the way, if you're considering a career in Kiruv, that's the wrong answer. You're supposed to say, good for you, proud Jew. Okay, right? Jot that down. Yeah. I said, why'd you break up with him? She says, because my Judaism is so important. I said, what does that mean? She says, you know, the holidays. I said, you could be intermarried and have a menorah in the window. You could be intermarried and have a Passover Seder. What does it mean? She says, I don't know. I said, so what would you do if somebody pulls out a gun and puts it to your head and should Jew convert or die? What would you do? She looks at me and says, I would let myself be killed. I said to her, never. You broke up with a man you love. You're prepared to die for something and you don't know what it is. I know I'm Jewish, but I don't know why. Ask the average Jew today, why are you Jewish? My parents were Jewish. And their parents were Jewish. And their parents were Jewish. And if they were Christian, I'd be Christian. If they were Muslim, I'd be Muslim. And if they were Nazis, I'd probably be Nazis. I'm very easygoing. I don't like to ask too many questions. I was born a Jew, so I'm a Jew. Which is a terrible answer, as we all know. And yet, go and ask a frum person the same question. Why are you a Jew? Why? Why are you a frum Jew? Because I was born a frum Jew. And if you were born Christian, I'd probably be Christian. How many of us, if we were Christian, would convert to Judaism? How many people want to think about that? You know what I mean? I'm a frum Jew because I was born a frum Jew. And if I was born a Christian, I'd be a Christian. Born a Muslim, I'd be a Muslim. I don't want to think too much. You go and ask the average frum person, why are you doing this? You know? What are you doing in this world? Why are you a frum Jew? What are we doing here? How many people can answer that question? It's scary. Try it on your own. Ask frum people. Don't ask non-frum people. That's too scary. No, you know, that's too easy. I mean, go ask frum people. Why are you a frum Jew? I was born a frum Jew. And what if you were born Christian? And you know how many times people have told me? Yeah, if I found out tomorrow that my mother wasn't really Jewish, I don't know that I'd be a guy. I don't know. Why not? Oh, she'd be sharing mitzvahs in Noah. It's a lot easier. Why not? Why not? How are we supposed to bring people to something that we don't think is the greatest thing in the world? The greatest thing in the world. That if I was offered everything else, I wouldn't give this up. That's scary. That's scary. And if we don't have clear for ourselves why we're doing this and what it's all about and that it is exciting, and it's the best thing in the world, says Masil Shasharim, you know why we're here? Here's the answer. To get pleasure from Hashem and enjoy the divine light, because that's the greatest pleasure that there is. I asked this once to a group of yeshiva guys. What did he say? Why are we in this world? Avodas Hashem. Nope. Try again. To get pleasure from Hashem and enjoy the divine light, because that's the greatest pleasure there is. Why are we in this world? To get the divine light. Wrong. I heard divine light. Right. Now listen to the whole sentence. That's always difficult. We usually pick out a phrase. We're supposed to get pleasure from Hashem and enjoy the divine light because that's the greatest pleasure there is. Nikuda. Hashem did not make us to serve him. He's very secure. Don't worry. He can take care of himself. He's good. He's fine. HaKadosh Baruch Hu created us in this world for one reason. To get the greatest possible pleasure. That's it. Which means that if a person is being a frum Jew, and he doesn't know why, and he's just going through the motions. We had a Teichacha this week. There's another one in Kisavo. Everyone knows the Pasuk, the terrible, terrible, frightening Pasuk. You know where all these calls come? Because we didn't serve Hashem with happiness. Says Rabbi Bechai, that means you kept all the mitzvos. But you weren't happy about it. You weren't excited about it. I did HaKadosh Baruch Hu a favor. Those of you who may have gone to sleepaway camp, I don't know how it works in the girls' camps. You know, I know in the boys' camps, there are three madrigas. There's what's called a camper. A camper's day is very regimented. They know. They have to get up in the morning, and they have to go to davening, and they have to go to breakfast, and they have to go to clean up, and they have to go to the infirmary and get their allergy shots. I don't know if they still do that. When I was a kid, they did. You know what I mean? Then you have swim instruction, 9 o'clock in the morning in August up in the mountains. It's freezing cold. All of the counselors are wearing sweatsuits and parkas, and little kids are shivering a little. Swim instruction! Don't push you into the freezing cold water. There's no way out. 4 periods of baseball, you know what I mean? Mandatory rest time. Nothing to do but play rafter ball and bunk. You know what I mean? And that's for campers. Counselors, their day is just as regimented. Counselors, get your campers up. Campers, get your counselors up. Let's go, go, go. They have to go. They have to go to every period. They have to go with you. They have to stay with you. They have to babysit you. Then there are waiters. Waiters are Briebefneatzman. They do their own thing. They have to be there in the morning to set up breakfast, serve breakfast, clean up breakfast. Then they're off. They can go back to the bunk and go to sleep. You know what I mean? They can sit outside on the grass. They can read. They have to be back for lunch. Set up lunch, serve lunch, clean up lunch. And then they can use the lake whenever they want. They can go swimming. They can go into town as long as they're back for supper. Set up supper, serve supper, clean up supper. Then they can start fires, beat up little kids, do anything they want. Their job is very clear. That's all they have to do. Unfortunately, that's how most from Jews look at life. Okay, Kodesh Baruch Hu, I davened, now leave me alone. Somebody once said to me, oh, great, I went to daven, Milcha Gedolah, you know, because, I was running off to take care of something. The guy says, oh, this is, my grandfather used to say, the greatest thing is to be parav and gedavened. You know, I have no limitations. I've got all away with as much as I can. I'm parav, all foods are open to me. That's why many Jews suffer from a psychological condition known as fleishophobia, the fear of becoming fleishes. You go to somebody and say, you want to taste the soup? No. What if I want ice cream or a coffee? I can't. Well, it's a 6-hour commitment, you know what I mean? You know? And you wonder why there are so many Jewish singles, you know what I mean? You know? People go into a sweat over a 6-hour commitment, you know? Baruch Bear came to America, you know? And his balabas would ask him every day, what do you want for lunch? Fleishiks. You know? And he says, the Rav never wants milchiks. He says, when I eat fleishiks, except for at least for 6 hours, I have to remember there's a God in the world. You know what I mean? At least for 6 hours. And us, we're really nervous. Parav and gedavend. I want to keep my options open. Okay, Kodesh Baruch Hu, I davened. All right, leave me alone. No lightning bolts. We're okay with each other. Fine. I said to somebody once, I was talking to Beis Yaakov. I said, okay, what do you do? You finished all your mitzvahs. You davened, you learned, you said extra Tehillim, you helped your mother, you helped your married sister, you helped the neighbor, you know what I mean? You read to the blind, you know, you did everything. There's not a mitzvah in sight. What do you do now? Now I do what I want. I read a book, I go shopping, I talk to my friends. Torah is something that people fit in around their life. That's why people have such a hard time when they look at this doctor. He's got a good marriage. He's happy, he's secure. He does meaningful work. I can't tell him why he should be from. You know why? Because he's missing everything. If a person doesn't have a kesher with a Kodesh Baruch Hu, you have nothing. I don't care if he eat kosher and keep Shabbos. I'll tell you a really depressing idea. I've told you a few, and I want to give a few more. Someone said, can you give me a positive thought? I said, no, but I'll give you 2 negatives. Anyway. My father-in-law davened in a shtiebel, and it was an aging population, and they realized they had to bring in younger people. So they bring in younger people, you know, and he says to me, I see something I have never seen. By the kiddush, they all bring fancy bottles of liquor, you know, and he says, and they drink at the kiddush, and they go home drunk. He says to me, everyone knows Jews don't drink. Jews don't drink, you know. That's a scary observation. We know this is happening all around the world. A friend of mine told me that he knows somebody in the hard liquor business, and the fastest growing market in America is the Orthodox market for hard liquor. You know? And always to me, Jews don't drink. That's for the goyim. The goyim drink. The Jews don't drink. When I got married 28 years ago, so my father said, listen, sometimes you have to make a simcha. Go out and buy a bottle of Shivas Regal. Buy a bottle of Crown Royal. It'll last you the rest of your life. Because nobody's going to drink. I remember when I was a kid, who drank? The old men at the kiddush who were having, you know, a herring on a kichel, you know what I mean? They'd say, ah, b'chaim, b'chaim, it burnt, it stunk, it was horrible, you know what I mean? It was like, you know, terrible, you know? Who would drink this stuff, you know? So I'm in Israel a few years, and these three yeshiva bachrim come and bring me a bottle of shivas. Usually expect the 4 shekel, but that's wine, you know? Bring a bottle of shivas, it's a lifetime supply. When they left, it was empty. And I didn't have any. You know what I mean? Suddenly I said to myself, we're not in Kansas anymore, Toto. You know what I mean? Something's changing here. Then guys would come and I'd say, you know, oh, you want a l'chaim after the fish? You know, most people would say no. They say, well, you have any single malt scotch? I said, well, is that Chivas or Crown Royal? No, it's Glenlivet, Glenn Miller, Glenn Bob, you know. Yeah. And I was like, I don't know. So I travel a lot, go to duty free, I buy different bottles, you know what I mean? And I see, I had to take the bottles off the table. People would, you know, I won't just drink anything. I won't just drink anything, you know? A guy says to me, you know, a Rebbe in a yeshiva, he says, he's one of the bachrim come over to him, and a good yeshiva, you know. He says, what do you guys want from me? I think that was a reference to the Tzevet, you know, to the rebellion. What do you guys want from me? You know, he says, you want me to sit here and learn all day, you know, the rest of my life? I want to go into my father's business, and I want to make a lot of money, and I want to marry a beautiful girl, and I want to buy her clothes and jewelry and travel. I have his number, if anyone's interested. And I want to live in a big house, you know what I mean? I want to eat fine food, go out to nice restaurants, you know what I mean? I want to drink the finest scotch, drink the, you know, best wine, you know? What's wrong with that? This is what the Rebbe asked me. What do I tell him? I said, it's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. If you're a guy, it's the perfect lifestyle. I want a big house. I want fine food, fine wine, fine liquor. I want the best of every gashmias this world has. And I'll also learn a daf yomi. The guy says, well, I'll also learn a daf yomi. I said, so what? So you're a guy, you'll learn a daf yomi. You know what I mean? A guy was learning with a fellow for like 3 years, daf yomi. And then he says, by the way, I'm making a bar mitzvah the Shabbos. He says, oh, mazel tov. He says, I'd like you to come. He says, I'd love to. He says, I want to give you an aliyah. He says, I can't. He says, why? He says, I'm a guy. He says, you're a guy? He says, yeah. He says, but you learned daf yomi. He says, oh, wonderful intellectual exercise. He says, but I see you in shul every Shabbos. Oh, I love coming to shul on Shabbos. You know, it's such a beautiful davening, all the singing. Anyway, I don't know what he does, but well, the singing's so nice. He goes, but you keep Shabbos. He says, oh, nice family time. He says, but we learned the Gemara in Sanhedrin. A guy is also to keep Shabbos. He says, so before I leave my house in the morning, I put a handkerchief in my pocket. He says, but we have an Erev. He says, you hold from that Erev? So you're married from Goy, and you learned that young man. But what's your life about? The finest wine. I remember seeing an ad for Baron Herzog. It's not the finest kosher wine. It's the finest wine. Nikuda. That's it. I don't want the finest kosher wine. I want the finest wine. When I was growing up, there was only one type of kosher wine. Extra heavy Malaga. You take it with a spoon and put it into the cup. You know what I mean? You take a sip. You know what I mean? You have an instant headache. You know? That's what was wine. It came in a gallon jug. You know what I mean? You know? And now everybody wants only the finest wine. I want only the finest liquor. I want the finest of everything. Jews don't drink. You know what the answer is? Because we're not thinking like Yidden anymore. You know why? Because we're doing mitzvos. Now we eat a matzah. Now we give tzedakah. Now we daven. Now we do this. Now we do that. That's not going to bring anybody into Yahadus. Nobody. The only thing that's going to bring a person in is if we can show them, I have a relationship with the Kodesh Baruch Hu. People say to me, how do I have a relationship with Kodesh Baruch Hu? So I said, you have to talk to him. By the way, don't do this in front of people, because they'll take you away, you know. But he said, no, I daven. I said, I didn't say daven. I'm not talking about davening. We all know how people daven, okay, you know. A little bit more, a little bit less, but like, you know, basically they push the automatic davening button. Those are already the people with a lot of kavana, you know? I've been to certain minyanim where like I take 3 steps back, the guy next to me goes, I said, that's impossible. How could you do that fast? You know what I mean? You see people miss Yalav Yavo, it's like, you know, they go, dun 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 dun. He's done Shmoneh Esrei 5 times. I haven't gotten out of the first bracha. You know what I mean? So people say, no, I know what I'm saying because I have an art scroll sitter. I said, that's very good. It used to be you didn't know what you were saying in Hebrew. Now you don't know what you're saying in English. But it still has no meaning to you. So you say, Lahodos, Lahalel, Shabbat, Lahalel, 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 Lahalel You don't know what it means. Look in the English. To praise, Lord, glorify, exalt, make high, make most high, most exalted, very laudable. You know what I mean? That doesn't have any more meaning to us. You know? So we daven. But is the Kodesh Baruch real? You know how many people have said to me, I know there's a God, I just don't believe it. You know what I mean? Because the Kodesh Baruch, is he a part of our lives? His Aneg Al Hashem. His Aneg Al Hashem means that a Kodesh Baruch has to be a source, that it has to come to Shabbos and I have to feel Shabbos. And it comes to davening, I have to feel davening. It has to be a meaningful experience to me. People have to see that I have something better. You want to hear the worst question I ever get asked? Here's the worst question. People ask me sometimes, Rabbi, what's the worst question that you've ever been asked that you have trouble asking? I said, I'll tell you the worst question that people ask. They say, Rabbi, I hear everything you're saying. Torah is beautiful and from Kaidi is wonderful and everything's great and my happiness and connection and that. So how come I see so many from people who are walking around miserable? So my Rabbi Olowick said to me, you can't say that. You can say they look miserable, but you can't say they are miserable. And I said to him, I hear what you're saying, but I've asked this question to firm audiences over the years and no one ever gave me that answer. You know what I mean? Why do you see so many firm people who don't look like they've got something great? Why don't people see us and say, wow, I don't know what that person has, but I wish I had it. That's the greatest thing in the world. I meet people sometimes, you know, I remember when I used to teach on fellowships, you know, in Asia, people would say to me, Rabbi, you're the biggest challenge to my secular lifestyle. I said, really, which class did I give? He says, none of them, I don't listen when you talk. I said, okay. I said, what is it? He goes, I know I'm living the secular lifestyle and I can do whatever I want, and I do. And I know you're living this restrictive lifestyle and I can't help but feel you're having more fun in life than I am. I said, kills you, doesn't it? He said, yeah. I said, you're right, you loser. You know what I mean? I'm not doing this because I'm going to burn in hell. I have it for a fact I'm not going to be burnt in hell. I have an arrangement already with the Kodesh Baruch Hu, don't worry about it. I got to get out of Gehenna free card. You know what I mean? I'm not worried. I'm not doing it for that. I'm doing it because it's the greatest thing in the world. You know what I mean? It's unbelievable. I have to tell you how many times when I give this show over to front people, they ask me two questions. If it's true, why are you the only one saying it? You know what I mean? And how come my kids don't learn this in school? You know what I mean? I said, those are your sociological questions. Go ask a sociologist. I don't know. You understand? But to understand, his anegah shambleh and his intrinosai means that we have to be living in this world because we know we're getting something better than anything else that's out there. And I don't care how much money, how much pleasure, how much good marriage, how much anything a person has out there, if he doesn't have a connection to Kodesh Baruch Hu, he has nothing. And when we open him up and we bring him that, we're giving him life. We're giving him the whole purpose of everything. And the first place we have to start is in us. Because the more that we understand it, the more people can see it in us, then people are going to be drawn to us. I was once at a Shabbaton, and it was filled with a whole group of charming young people, you know, in their 20s, and they were all talking among themselves, and nobody was interested in talking to me. I had tried all of my different techniques I was taught. I asked them, would you rather be rich or happy? I asked them about life. And they didn't want to talk to me. They wanted to talk to each other. So, Friday night, so I closed my eyes, and I sang my smiras to myself, quietly. And when I opened my eyes, everybody was staring at me. And I said, I didn't realize I sang so bad. I'm sorry, you know. And they said, that's so beautiful. What is that? And I explained to them about smiras. And I explained about tunes. They felt there was something there that they were missing. They felt that there was a connection, something that you could feel that lifts you out of this world. That's got to be how we live. We have to daven and it has to be a meaningful experience. We have to keep Shabbos, and Shabbos has to be something beautiful. That, you know, that people ask me, how do you keep your kids at the Shabbos table? I said, I don't keep the kids at the Shabbos table. It's supposed to be at the Shabbos table. You know what I mean? People want to be at the Shabbos table, and if not, then you're running the wrong Shabbos table. You know what I mean? If I can't make it an exciting and beautiful experience, my Yahadus, what am I selling to somebody else? In the back of our mind, don't we say to ourselves, oh, I ruined another life. And so, my friends, it's been a long convention. The fact that so many people were willing to dedicate their time to spend an entire Shabbos to be able to be inspired on how to inspire ourselves to inspire other people is inspiring. How's that for name brand recognition, huh? And the fact of the matter is that there is no one in this world who cannot make a difference. I'm going to end with the story that I always end with, because I don't have that many, but no, because this is really the story that has had the most impact on me. The Chafetz Chaim spoke at the Aguda Convention, 1920s, how important it is for everybody to go out and do Kiruv, if you can imagine. And the Chafetz Chaim asked to speak again later in the program. Okay, the Chafetz Chaim wants to speak, you know. So you tell, you know, Chaim Oizer, please move to the side, you know what I mean? You know, there are some ach, you know, could you move aside? You know, we want him to speak. You know, Chafetz Chaim gets back up, he says, I heard people saying, when the Chafetz Chaim said everybody, he didn't mean me. You know, everybody doesn't mean me. I find this when I go to the mikveh, it says everybody must shower before they use the mikveh. It's the same concept. You know what I mean? I know. Certain people think it doesn't mean me. You know what I mean? So, but, you know, it says, you know, he said everybody doesn't mean me. I'm not smart enough. I'm not talented enough. I'm not this. I'm not that. You know? So he said, I'll give you a marshal. So it was a nobleman owned a large tract of land. And he had a lot of villages, and he was traveling around the villages. He comes to one village, he takes a drink of water. He says, this is terrible. It's filled with sand. He says, yeah, that's how the water is here. It's sandy. He says, well, you can't use this. I'm making an edict in this village. Before you use the water, you have to boil it. So, okay. A few weeks later, he's looking off into the distance, and he sees there's a fire. It doesn't seem like anyone's putting it out. So he gets into his horse and carriage. He rushes off into this village. And the village is burning down. And he says to the people, why don't you put out the fire? And he says, we want to, but we're waiting for the water to boil. He says, when I said boil the water, that was for drinking. That was for washing, for cooking. But when there's a fire, you take all the water you have and you throw it on. No one has the luxury to ask themselves whether the water is pure enough. I was running NCSY Long Island for 3 years. I went off to Eretz Yisrael to learn. And I was learning. It came, the learning was better than it had ever been. I didn't want to leave. I went to Reb Scheinberg, I went to Reb Elyoshiv. They both tell me I have to go back. And Purim, I had a little too much to drink. You know, heavy malaga hits your heart. And I didn't realize it. My mashkiach, Kari Kanarik, Chafetz Chaim called me over, and there were tears rolling down my face. And he says, Reb David, what's the matter? And I said, Rebbe, it's not fair, because I can help other people. I can't sit and learn for myself. So he says, Reb David, let me tell you a story. And he tells me this story, which I had told over many times. And I sat there patiently, because I already knew the punchline, and I was just ready to, you know, throw it right back. I wasn't that drunk. You know what I mean? And he finishes the whole story. And I said, Rebbe, but the water is still not fit to drink. And he looks at me and he says, Reb David, Halavai, we just put out the fire. There's not a lot of time left. Soon it's going to be difficult to even identify who Jews are. We're in the end game. We need everybody on. This is the end. If you ever read the 15 battles of the 15 decisive battles of world history, you found that history ranged on different battles where they went back and forth and back and forth, and it was a question of who had the stamina to go that last mile once more into the breach. This is it. We don't have the luxury to sit back. We have to make ourselves people who understand what Yahadus really is, and we have to be a beacon to everybody else, that they beat a path to our door and come to us and say to us, thank you, that because of you, I have a life of meaning. And Amir Tz Hashem, we'll be zoichet to be able to participate in this ourselves.